You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now think about the saying, find out what you're made of. Usually that's about character, values, toughness, more than, you know, the nuts and bolts of the human body. But what was the last time you actually got curious about what we are actually made of? Not just the hair and skin and organs and stuff, but the small stuff, the atoms. How about how the food we eat becomes us? In his new book, our next guest tackles these and other ultimate questions of life, the universe, and everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these things you are curious about, or were you as a kid? Do you have a question about what we're made of, what we're not made of, how we got to be what we are? Our next guest goes back to the Big Bang to start things off. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Levitt writes and produces science and history documentaries. His new book is called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I got to ask about the journey here, because if I thought of some of the starting questions you did, I might, you know, go online for a couple few minutes and then be done with it. Instead, you literally go from Big Bang to how we, you know, how our cells turn food into energy, plus the science behind it. What kicked off this journey?
You know, it started with a question. When my teenage daughter was thinking of becoming a vegetarian, I naturally was wondering what she would have to eat in order to remain healthy. And when I started thinking about it, I actually realized I have no idea what our bodies were made of. And a little bit more thinking, and I realized I actually don't even know where that stuff, whatever it was, came from. And then it kind of hit me, which was, wow, everything that's in our bodies now, every single particle actually started 13.8 billion years ago at the Big Bang. And so that kicked off a whole lot of Googling and questioning. And, you know, what I discovered is not just that it's an amazing journey from there to here, but also the fact that we are made of particles from the Big Bang, and we can actually reconstruct that journey and look back and figure out how we got here. That's also just amazing. So how scientists discovered it also was something that just absolutely fascinated me.
I'm gonna go to some of the things that fascinated me that I learned in your book. So you mentioned some of our material, or all of it, originated 13.8 billion years ago. The bits of us that are hydrogen, which is a fair amount of us, that's the original material. Those are the same atoms as when the universe started?
That's it. And that's 10% of your body. But all the other atoms, which are different elements like oxygen and carbon and so on, their constituents, the electrons and the protons that they're made of, also came right out of the Big Bang.
But they needed a little work, right? So those bigger atoms, the carbons and things like that, how did they end up existing in the universe, first of all, much less being part of us?
Yeah, so once the Big Bang happened, there was a huge amount of oxygen that went out in massive clouds into the expanding universe. A large collections of those condensed into stars. And once that hydrogen was at higher and higher pressures, which gravity contracted into this higher and higher pressures and temperatures, it fused helium, and that liberated energy. And that, and when it liberated energy and the star got hotter, then it was able to make heavier elements with more protons in the nucleus. Every element has an additional proton compared to the one before it on the periodic table. So as stars created heavier elements and it released more energy, that allowed the stars to make even heavier elements until the element iron, which has 40 protons in its nucleus. After that, the rest of the elements in the universe and in our body were made by the most powerful explosions in the universe, which were supernovas, the massive explosions of stars.
Okay, and that's all amazing. But then here's the really baffling thing to me. Most of me is nothing. There's gaps among the atoms, the molecules between them. There's more nothing than something in a human body.
Yeah, I really have a hard time getting my head around it as well. But if you look at an atom, like just a hydrogen atom, 99% of it is empty space. So if you took the nucleus and you blew it up so that it was the size of a tennis ball, the electrons are worrying a mile away. So there's a huge amount of empty space within our body, so much so that some of the tiniest particles that we know of, like, called neutrinos, they can just shoot right through us.
We are talking about what we're made of with author Dan Levitt. His new book is What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions, your experiences in studying these things, maybe at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, this is a good topic. It's something I've internalized. I've read recently that men, male Americans at least, part of a research study, are deficient in magnesium. And I read that the magnesium chemical or nutrient affects how our body, how the synergy of the energy affects, that magnesium affects the relationship between the atoms in our body, and the deficiency is a negative thing, and we need to eat more magnesium. Is that enough of a question?
Jeff, I got you. If you don't mind, Jeff, I'm going to take us on a detour into the 19th century, Dan, where scientists were really tackling questions of what do we need to eat? What happens if we eat these things? What happens if we don't eat these other things? Can you talk about the quest to narrow that down?
Yeah, well, that's fun because, in the 19th century, we didn't know that we do need some minerals like magnesium. And you might wonder how they ever figured it out. And one way they figured it out was they knew that our food has proteins, fats, carbohydrates in them. And so they made artificial food with those constituents and fed them to animals like laboratory rats. And they discovered that they got sick. And so by a process of deduction, they were able to figure out that, oops, you know, we need chlorine, we need magnesium, we need potassium, we need sulfur. There are certain mineral and iron we need to get from plants in addition to the other things that we already knew about.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Another component we need, and I want to go to this one because a lot of these were discovered at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, vitamins. And I want to get it. You share the story of scurvy, which I thought I knew, right? Sailors got scurvy. They didn't eat oranges. They didn't get enough vitamin C in their diet. Easy peasy. Except people figured this out and then forgot about it again and again. Can you talk about why it was so hard to connect the dots between this horrific condition that killed thousands of sailors and just eating some oranges?
Yeah, it's baffling when you look at the face of it. Scurvy is a terrible disease, and the British Navy suffered dreadfully from it. And there was a while when ship's captains knew that if they had fresh vegetables, and particularly if they had lemons or oranges, and fed them to their sailors, they wouldn't suffer from it. But I think people got very complacent about it. And the thing that was the real killer was, at the time, no one had the concept of a vitamin. A vitamin is a weird thing. You know that if you eat something, you'll get sick from it. But who would think that if you don't eat a tiny bit of something that you've never heard of, that'll also make you sick? And at the time, their theories of disease were about were really the Greek theories of the humors, that all the diseases they thought were created by these four humors in the body that were in imbalance. And so they didn't have the concept of a vitamin. And so it took a long, long time for them, for scientists to even get that idea in their heads. And in the meantime, the millions and millions of British sailors, among many, many other people, died from it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this is a bit of a tangent, and I apologize in advance. But I read a lot of Terry Pratchett's novels, and in a couple of the Discworld books, he includes a little song that, knowing Terry, I'm not sure how much of it is, you know, taken from actual old songs and how much of it is him, but it's iron enough to make a nail, lime enough to paint a wall, water enough to drown a dog, and it goes on like that for a little bit, and it's just talking about all the things that it takes to make a man, and I just thought it's kind of interesting that, you know, you go back all these hundreds, if not thousands of years, and people have you tried to figure out, like, okay, but what makes us alive?
I gotcha, Michael. Thanks a lot. You kind of break down how much of product element X it takes to make a human, as that song tried to do, Dan.
Yeah, I love that. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you have a carbon enough to make 25 pounds of charcoal. You've got enough salt in your body to fill a salt shaker. You have enough chlorine to disinfect a couple backyard swimming pools, and enough iron, your caller was exactly right, to make a 3-inch nail. And furthermore, he was right because your body is over 50% water.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to science and history documentarian Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about anything we've been talking about his journey to learn the history of the stuff we're made of, the atoms and molecules and nutrients and how they get there? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dan, before we go back to our callers, a big part of your book is about the scientists who made the discoveries you're looking at and the workings of science. And an amazing theme seems to be scientists propose this idea. Everybody dismisses it as ridiculous, but then some of them say, okay, I'm going to try to disprove it. And they can't disprove it, and it becomes accepted science. What did you learn just about the way scientific progress works?
You know, I always thought that that science is just follow the evidence. But when I was researching all of these amazing discoveries, I discovered that at the time that they were first presented, so many of them, the vast preponderance of them that I looked at in my book, were just completely dismissed when they were initially presented, or the scientists treated them with complete scorn. And you know, so I discovered that there were six particular reasons that made whole communities of scientists very skeptical of radical new discoveries, not incremental ones, but radical ones. You know, one of them, I gave them nicknames, right? One of them is the too weird to be true bias. When scientists first proposed that the universe was not static, but was expanding, I mean, huh? No way, right? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. You know, when scientists first proposed that organic molecules, which are the molecules that our bodies are made of, which are not rock, but they are longer chains of molecules could exist in space, people were completely skeptical. And then often people had faith in the world's greatest experts and didn't always examine really carefully the assumptions that those experts made. And so, you know, I learned that these kinds of cognitive biases in the short term, not in the long term, but in the short term, can really, really retard science, because scientists, they're just not very different from any of us. We all have unconscious assumptions that often we don't bring to the fore. And when we do, sometimes we're just wrong.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chet is with us in Maquanago. Chet, hi.
Hello, it's Chet. Yeah, nice to hear from you. I'm totally relating to what you're saying about the everything you eat makes you. I teach a botany class to a bunch of fifth graders, and I'll start the day saying, first I'll say, my I'll show my thumbnail. So you see this thumbnail? That's a pork chop I had about a week ago. You know, and but the funnest thing I like to do, and I think this relates to what you're saying, is I'd like to start the class off also with a question. I would say, I would ask them, or tell them, I says, well, everything you eat comes from the soil. And they would often argue with me, you know, no, what if you were raised in a cannibal family, or what about fish and all this other stuff they would ask me. But the thought that everything you eat comes from the soil was, it seemed kind of radical too, but it always ends up there. And then it always seems to end with us saying, well, who makes the soil for us, you know? And it's the trees, and that's how I get into the botany end of it. But the trees and the plants make soil for us so we can grow food, so that we can make fingernails. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Chet, thanks a lot for the call. And Dan, you spend some time on photosynthesis and the mystery of how plants convert energy from the, or it was a mystery of how plants convert energy from the sun, and that does all the things that Chet just said.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we really are creatures of plants, and it all goes back to photosynthesis. You know, when I was in school, I probably learned about photosynthesis, but I paid it no mind. Now I think it's the most amazing reaction ever in the world. It was invented by bacteria several billion years ago. Now, it's in plants. And here's what it is. You take carbon dioxide from the air, you take hydrogen from water, and you take energy from the sun, and you make sugar out of it. And then from that sugar, you can make other organic compounds. So this is one of the many mind-blowing things that I learned in the book, is that 93% of your mass actually comes from photosynthesis. 83% of your mass was once just carbon dioxide floating in the air, and another 10% was hydrogen that was in the water. So, you know, we really are completely products, in a sense, of both plants and photosynthesis.
Thanks for that call, Chet. We're talking to Dan Levitt about his new book, What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Staying with the mind-blowing theme, Dan, part of that process that took a while to figure out also was how cells convert stuff to energy, and just the sheer rate of what's going on, the chemical reactions in a cell. Can you give us a sense of the scale, how quickly our cells are creating energy for us?
So there's an energy currency in our cells called ATP, and your average cell consumes and therefore has to remake 10 to 100 million of them every single second. And the way it does that is unbelievable. This was another incredible thing that I learned, which is it's done in a little chemical factory in your cell called a mitochondria. The mitochondria has little electric currents inside, made not of electrons, but of protons. Again, protons from the Big Bang. And those protons drive these nanomachines, these unbelievable nanomachines called ATP synthase. And why I call them machines is that they've got a rotor that spins at up to 300 revolutions per second. And then there's another piece that creates the ATP, and it's connected, interlinked to another piece that kicks the ATP off into the cell. It's a very beautiful, sophisticated machine, and it kind of looks almost water wheelish, like something that Leonardo da Vinci would create. And that creates all of the energy in your body. Fun thing about that is, if you were to take all the mitochondria in your body that create your energy and lay them out flat, they would cover 2 basketball courts. There are that many of them.
Wow.
And they create as much energy in your body as a 100-watt light bulb.
In the book, you tackle a lot of answered questions, things that we figured out. Well, people smarter than me figured out over the decades. What to you are a couple of the biggest still unanswered questions about what makes us what and who we are?
Well, the origin of life is a topic, is a subject that we have a lot of very good theories about, but that one, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. How exactly did the first cell form? And then the big one that I don't tackle in my book is consciousness. You know, I do talk a lot about how the molecules in our cells, 100 trillion molecules in each of our 30 trillion cells creates life. And we know a tremendous amount about that. But then how all the nerve cells in our brain create consciousness, that's still one of the biggest mysteries in science.
Having gone through this process and written this book, do you look at your food differently now?
Yes. There's a wonderful quote that one scientist said is when I see people walking down the street, essentially I'm paraphrasing, I see plants rearranged.
Do you feel different as a human being, as a holder of these 13 billion year old atoms?
You know, I do. Because, I learned that even the simplest cell is unbelievably complex and worthy of respect. And we are made of 30 trillion cells. I mentioned that each one has 100 trillion atoms. If they were each the width, the thickness of a dollar bill, and you were to stack them up, they would go up to the moon and back like almost 30 times. So it's almost impossible for us to appreciate how truly sophisticated we are. Our cells are filled with all kinds of unbelievable sophisticated mechanisms that were built by, again, from particles that came down to Earth willy-nilly, ultimately from the Big Bang.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dan Levitt. He's a documentarian who produces films about science and history. We talked to him about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang through Last Night's Dinner. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, we've talked over the years a lot about addiction and substance abuse here on the show. Our next guest says we can learn a lot from addiction treatment about a related problem in our lives, compulsive overconsumption. That could be anything from compulsive shopping, a computer game habit, constantly checking our social media and our phones. What ties all those together? The system of pain and pleasure in our brains and dopamine in particular. We're taking a look now at dopamine and its role in a wide variety of problems, from substance abuse disorders to compulsively checking our phones. In her new book, our next guest says that modern excess has made us all the more vulnerable to addiction and to compulsive behaviors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these, or have you had one of these experiences, a compulsive behavior? Binge watching shows past the point where it feels healthy, constantly checking social media, eating, you name it. How do they make you feel? Did you find a way to cut down on them? Do you have questions about how all this works in our lives and in our brains? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Anna Lemke is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. She's the author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
As I mentioned, we talk a lot about addiction and substance abuse disorder. I'd like, if you would, for you to introduce this concept of compulsive overconsumption. It's got overlap with what we think of as addiction, but it might involve a lot of activities that we might not think of as addictive. What do we mean by that?
Well, addiction is a spectrum disorder, and it is possible to be a little bit addicted, which means that we engage in behaviors in a compulsive, out of control way that is ultimately not in line with our goals and values, and may even be harming us and other people. And this can apply not just to things that we put in our bodies, including food, but can also apply to behaviors, things like gambling, shopping, pornography, masturbation, video games, social media, cryptocurrency, online chess, you name it. I have probably heard of pretty much every compulsive overconsumption / addiction type behavior you could imagine. Why? Because we all have the same ancient machinery that has us reflexively approaching pleasure and avoiding pain. It's called the pleasure-pain balance, or at least that's what I call it. And it's wonderfully adapted to a world of scarcity, but not so much for a world of overwhelming overabundance, which is the world we live in now.
Let's open up the hood on that machinery and one of the key ingredients in the title of your book, dopamine. What is it? Why is it such a big part of this story?
Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical that we make in our brain. It's fundamental to the experience of pleasure, reward, and motivation. It's also important for movement. That's no coincidence. Most organisms have to move to get the reward they want. But humans have been able to engineer our ecosystem so that we can just sit on the couch, swipe right and swipe left, and get our heart's desire. And this is very problematic for the brain, because what happens is that now we're releasing huge amounts of dopamine in the reward pathway very quickly. And that is not what our brains evolve for. And the result is that we're all becoming vulnerable to the problem of addiction, because what our brains do in the presence of these sudden intense spikes of dopamine is that our brains adapt by, in fact, downregulating our own dopamine production and transmission, not just to baseline tonic levels of dopamine firing, but actually below baseline to a dopamine deficit state. That's the come down, the hangover, the after effect. And with repeated exposure to high amounts of dopamine, a fire hose of dopamine, if you will, what essentially happens is we end up in a chronic or long-term dopamine deficit state, which is akin to a clinical depression. And I think that is the reason, or at least part of the reason, why we're seeing increasing rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide all over the world, but especially in rich nations. Of course, trauma, socioeconomic disparity, and many other stressors play a role, but I contend that it is the stress of overwhelming overabundance and the drugification of modern life that is in fact driving our brains to be in a physiologic dopamine deficit state, which feels exactly like depression.
I want to hammer that home a little bit. Let's say I like something like I do computer games. I mostly play them in a healthy way. At points in my life, I've definitely played them too much. That first bit of playing feels nice. I probably get a little bit of that dopamine. But if I keep doing it again and again and again, I can speak from experience. It gets less fun over time. I feel worse about it. That same amount of time spent playing isn't as fun. That's what's going on with that dopamine cycle, in effect?
Exactly. So exposure to highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors over time will, in fact, change our brain and reset our hedonic or joy set point, such that our pleasure-pain balance becomes chronically tilted to the side of pain. And now we need more and more pleasure, not to feel good, but just to feel normal. And when we're not engaging in our intoxicant, we are in a depressed state, a dopamine deficit state, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving.
Talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the book Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke is an expert on addiction, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you willing to share your experience with this kind of compulsive habit, behavior, whatever you want to call it? Is that something you have now, maybe with social media, shopping, a substance, the list goes on and on? Did you find a way to break out of it? Love to hear it. If you did, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, it seems like a challenge here when we're talking about something that, you know, isn't a known dangerous drug, a heroin or something like that. How do we know when we've crossed the line from, hey, this is a thing I like to do and have fun doing, to this is a compulsive overconsumption of this thing?
You need to look for the three C's: control, compulsion, and consequences. So out of control use means using more than we planned or intended to, or more than is consistent with our goals and values, including opportunity costs. So what are the things we're not doing because we're spending so much time doing a particular behavior or a particular drug? Compulsion refers to a lot of our mental real estate now being occupied by thinking about our drug to the exclusion of other things, as well as a level of automaticity. around initiating our drug use. And again, I use the term drug very broadly to incorporate behaviors as well. And then most importantly, we want to look for consequences. These can be relationship consequences, work consequences, health consequences, especially continued consequences, continued use despite consequences. So those are the signs that we look for as people are tipping from recreational or even self-medication kind of use into overuse, compulsive use, and addictive use. Other soft signs to look for are when we start to lead the double life or lie about our consumption to other people. This is very classically happens as people become addicted. They tend to sort of lead, again, this double life where they're not even being honest with themselves about what they're using and how they're spending their time. The other soft sign to look for is to think about and be very mindful of not just how we feel when we're doing our drug, but how we feel afterward. So to take your example of the video games, you can certainly remember the kind of pleasure you initially felt when you were playing video games, but now think about how you felt as you were trying to stop or right after you stopped. That brings into awareness this kind of dopamine free fall that happens when we stop using a highly intoxicating substance or drug.
We're talking to Dr. Anna Lemke about her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these experiences, are these ideas sounding familiar to you, something you're dealing with now or went through earlier in your life? How did you get through it? Did you find ways to change habits, separate yourself from whatever it is that might have triggered this compulsive overconsumption of, you fill in the blank of what? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Anna Lemke, author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Gary is with us in southern Wisconsin. Gary, hello.
Hi there. I have come in an unusual story. I had a tremendous amount of tragedy when I was younger, about 21 years old. My sister was killed in a car accident. I was in the car accident, didn't walk for 2 years, had 14 surgeries. My dad later, a year after that, committed suicide. I was so depressed, I went to a doctor. They misdiagnosed me as schizophrenic and put me on Stelazine. Now, anybody that researches Stelazine knows that it down-regulates dopamine dramatically. And since that period, I've always had trouble with depression. So after many, many years, I've now had over 20 surgeries, and, you know, I try to do what I can to lift my mood, but because of that Stelazine damage to my brain, I always have trouble. I take like L-tyrosine, L-phenylalanine, that type of thing. But I still have PTSD and tremendous pain all the time.
Gary, I'm so sorry you went through all of that, and best to you. Dr. Lemke, obviously we can't diagnose Gary here, but that idea of medications that suppress dopamine, it seems like that would be something we'd want to be really careful with.
Well, it's an interesting call. And yeah, Gary, gosh, I would think what jumps out at me is your incredible resilience at enduring so much life tragedy and coming through the other side. You know, Stelazine is a dopamine receptor antagonist. It's used to treat psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. I'm not aware of any research showing that it leaves a long-lasting dopamine deficit state. You know, it's possible, I suppose, but really typically once people stop taking a medication like Stelazine, it will no longer be blocking those dopamine receptors and shouldn't really leave any long-term residual damage. So, you know, it's hard to know, Gary, whether it's the medicine or whether it's your life tragedies that set you up for depression, or whether, you know, there are all the surgeries. I mean, there are so many reasons why, you know, your life has been harder. But it's an interesting point, and it's an interesting question, the ways that chemicals that limit dopamine might have some long-lasting effect. Although, again, I'm not aware of any research showing that.
Gary, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Martin joins us now in Duluth. Martin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Martin?
Well, the question of rewarding yourself for breaking a bad habit, and whether there's what kind of merit or not merit there is to that. Years ago, when I quit smoking cigarettes, I rewarded myself with buying a lot of expensive camping gear. And I'm assuming that's probably not a bad idea. I just want to hear her comments.
Interesting, Martin. That idea, Dr. Lebke, of replacing that habit we don't want, that addiction, with something better. What do you think?
Right. So there have been a lot of popular books written about doing just what you did, Martin, when trying to give up a bad habit, replace the one reward with another reward, as you did with the buying camping gear. The problem with that is twofold. First of all, there's the risk of cross-addiction, where you could get addicted potentially to shopping. It sounds like you didn't, or at least you didn't elaborate on that. So that's good news. But the other problem with replacing one reward with another is that we're merely just continuing to prime our dopamine reward pathway. Whereas the intervention that I recommend in the book is to actually simply abstain from the highly reinforcing drug or behavior for long enough to reset reward pathways and let dopamine firing come back up to normal baseline levels. Now, obviously, that's easier said than done, but that is the recommendation that I have, as opposed to this idea of replacing rewards, which doesn't quite reset reward pathways and may lead to a new addiction.
Thanks for calling in, Martin, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, I want to stay with strategies to help get out of these addictions. You talk about this idea in the book of self-binding, not just counting on willpower, which I know wouldn't work for me, but framing our lives, separating ourselves from the temptation. What kind of things are you talking about?
So this is using literal and metacognitive barriers between ourselves our drug of choice so that we can press the pause button between desire and consumption. So for example, with a video game addiction, this would mean eliminating all of the video games from our various devices. Maybe if we have some kind of game console, putting that away for the 4-week period of the dopamine fast, long enough to reset reward pathways so that we can really then engage our willpower more successfully and not exhaustively. With a food addiction, this would involve getting that food of choice out of the house and only keeping the kind of healthier foods that we're wanting to eat. With a more typical cannabis or alcohol or other drug use disorder, this would mean getting that drug out of the house, and also generally avoiding people, places, and things that might trigger us to use our drug. What's really interesting about triggers is that they also release dopamine, and we get a little bit high just thinking about or being reminded of our drug of choice, followed by a little mini dopamine deficit state, which is the state of craving, which then motivates us to use. So part of overcoming any kind of addiction means not just insulating ourselves from the actual drug, but also insulating ourselves to the extent possible from reminders or triggers of the drug.
We are talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, addiction expert, author of the book Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. We heard on Twitter from Leah, who writes, "Tanning was my addiction through high school and college, using tanning beds." Leah says, "I love the quick dopamine and results it would provide. I've since stopped tanning and have accepted my natural skin tone, and I'm healthier for it," she writes. That idea of accepting life without whatever addiction is, Dr. Lemke, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks, Leah. I love that you brought this up, because it really does speak to the ways in which we can get addicted to many different types of reinforcers. And in the case of tanning beds, it's not just the look that probably was reinforcing or potentially addictive, but probably it was the physiologic response you got from the tanning itself. So the chemical boost, the little dopamine hit you got from the tanning. So I think, you know, a big part of recovery from any addiction or compulsive overconsumption is readjusting ourselves to a life that's not full of these highs and lows, but somewhere in between. A patient of mine who had a very severe opioid addiction and who got into recovery and was grateful for his recovery, but missed some of the drama and excitement of his addicted life, actually turned toward tabletop games where he could assume certain characters and engage in excitement through the drama of the tabletop game rather than in his real life, which was more drama than he needed or wanted. Sometimes we encourage patients to do sort of secretly radical things to allow them to adjust to the sometimes boring, a nature of everyday life. And this can be things like just wearing really exciting underwear or something like that.
Time for one more caller. Laura is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Laura, hi.
Yes, hi. I was calling to find out if this dopamine situation might have any relationship to a person who is a hoarder, where in the acquisition of the items that they tend to hoard, that there's the satisfaction, there's, you know, a high that they kind of get out of it.
Laura, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left, but Dr. Lemke, I'm guessing the answer is yes, dopamine could be part of that acquiring and keeping stuff, hoarding.
Oh, most certainly. So that cycle of acquisition and the anticipation and pleasure we get from collecting things and keeping things definitely involves dopamine. In the book, I talk about a patient who got addicted to buying things on Amazon, went into thousands of dollars in debt, had rooms full of keychains, sunglasses, and mugs he didn't need. And for him, it was really the process of acquisition, choosing the item, waiting for it to come. The moment he opened it and got it, he went into a severe dopamine deficit state withdrawal and then was back on the computer again looking for the next thing.
Thanks for that call, Laura. In our last minute or so, Dr. Lemke, part of the point in your book is it's really easy for us to find the things that make us feel good and then they stop making us feel good. You suggest we lean into the rest of life, the parts that don't always feel so good. How can we do that?
Well, what we've found is that by pressing on the pain side of the balance, which is to say doing things intentionally that are difficult, like exercise, ice cold water plunges, or anything that requires iterative endurance, attention, and effort, is a way to get dopamine indirectly. Because what we're doing when we expose ourselves to mild to moderate, noxious, or toxic stimuli, which actually exercise is, for example, is that we're telling our bodies, oh, there's an injury here, it's time to upregulate or make more of the feel-good neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. So it turns out that intentionally inviting hard things into your life is a great way to get dopamine without going into a dopamine deficit state. Obviously, you don't want to overdo it. Mm-hmm. It is possible to get addicted to pain, but in general, this is a very good strategy.
Dr. Lemke, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to the callers.
That's Dr. Anna Lemke, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. She talked to us about her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. It came out in paperback this month. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.